Early in April, 1931, Valentine Minder, of Hapoch, Long Island, NY, was suffering with what was said to be mastoiditis. His 8 children were stricken with what was said to be measles, and then, one after another, in a period of 8 days, the 8 children were taken ill with mastoiditis, and were removed to a hospital. The circumstance, because of which these cases were called unparalleled, is that mastoiditis was supposed to be not contagious. These cases, which, if unparalleled, were mysterious, were a culmination of a series of misfortunes. About 2 years before, Minder's home had burned down. Then came his illness, a loss of vitality, the loss of his job, and a state of destitution. Toward the end of 1930, Mrs. Minder was stricken with an indefinable illness, and became an invalid. So far as was known, mastoiditis is not contagious. Out of many cases of family maladies, misfortunes, and fatalities, I pick one in which it seems that even more decidedly there is no place for the idea of contagion. Of course there is a place for the idea of coincidence. That is one square peg that fits into round holes and octagonal holes, dodecagonal holes, cracks, slits, gaps or seems to, so long as whether it does or doesn't is not inquired into. London Daily Chronicle, November 3, 1926. That Mr. A. C. Peckover, the well-known violinist, one of the examiners to the Royal College of Music, had at the home of his sister, in Skipton, awakened one morning, to find himself blind. He was taken to the Bradford Eye and Ear Hospital. Here was his father, who, almost simultaneously, had been stricken with blindness. In the matter of the deaths that followed the opening of Tutankhamen's tomb, it is my notion that, if curses there be, they lose their vitality, anyway after several thousand years. Or that a tomb was violated, and that funerals followed by the deadly magic of no mummy, but of a living Egyptian that, somewhere in Egypt, a sense of desecration became an obsession, from which came rays, or a more personal and searching vengeance. I wonder why the wealthy farmer appears in so many records of more or less uncanny doings. Perhaps any farmer who becomes wealthy, so becomes by sharp practices, and has enemies, whose malices against him demonstrate. In November, 1890, the household of Stephen Haven, a wealthy farmer, living near Fowlerville, Michigan, was startled by cries, one night. Haven was found at the bottom of a deep well. He had walked in his sleep. 2 months later, he was again missing from his bedroom, was searched for and was found, standing, with the water up to his neck, in Silver Lake. Other members of the family were alarmed and alert. They heard slight sounds. One night Haven was found, fast asleep, trying to set the house afire. Another time and a thud was heard. The man, asleep, had tried to hang himself. According to the story, as told in the Brooklyn Eagle, November 18, 1892, Haven had finally been found dead at night. He had fallen from the upper story doorway of his barn. See back to occurrences in Sing Sing Prison, in December, 1930. New York Herald Tribune, January 18, 1932. Warden Louis E. Laws fell this evening on the sleet-covered steps of his home, at the prison, and his right arm was broken in 3 places. In matters of witchcraft, my general expression as I say, to signify that neither as to anything in this book, nor anywhere else, have I beliefs. My general expression upon poltergeist girls is not that they are mediums, controlled by spirits, but that effects in their presence are phenomena of their own powers, or talents, or whatever, but that there are cases in which it seems to me that youngsters were mediums, or factors, not to spirits, but to living human beings, who had become witches, or wizards, by their hates or that, in some cases, sorcery, unless so involuntarily accomplished, cannot operate. See back to the Dag case. Here there seemed to be a girl's own phenomena, and also the presence of another being, who was invisible. The story was probably largely a distortion. The story was that there was a feud that a voice accused a neighbor, Mrs. Wallace, of having sent it into the Dag home. If this woman could invisibly transport herself into somebody else's home, for purposes of malice and persecution, we'd not expect her to accuse herself, but there is such an element in a hate, as a sense of dissatisfaction with injuring an enemy, unless the victim knows who's doing it. Also, the accusation was soon confused into an acquittal. I have noted a case of occurrences in a shop, in London, which I tell of, mostly because it has highly the look of authenticity. Not a girl but a boy was present. I'd think that the doings were his own phenomena, were it not for the circumstance of timing. By timing, in this case, I mean the occurrence of phenomena upon the same days of weeks. The phenomenon of timing, or the occurrences of doings, about the same time each day, appears in many accounts of persecutions by invisibles, for which I have found no room, in this book. London Weekly Dispatch, August 18, 1907. Disturbances in the stationery shop of Arthur Herbert George, 20, Bute Street, South Kensington, London. According to Mr. George's sworn statement, before the Commissioner for Oaths, at 85 Gloucester Road, South Kensington. George and his assistant, a boy or a young man, aged 17, saw books and piles of stationery slide unaccountably from shelves. Everything that they replaced fell again, so that they could make no progress, trying to restore order. No vibration, no force of any kind, was felt. Two electric lamps in the window toppled over. Then there was livelier action. Packages of notepaper flew around, striking George and his assistant several times. George shut the door, so that customers should not come in and be injured. The next day, boxes of stationery and bottles of ink were flying around, and four persons were struck. To this statement was appended an affidavit by an antique dealer, Sidney Guy Adams, 23, Bute Street, testifying that he had seen heavy packages of notepaper flying around, and that he had been struck by one of them. In the Weekly Dispatch, September 1, it was said that there had been a repetition of the disturbances, upon the same days of the week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, as the days of former phenomena. The damage to goods amounted to about £10. Upon May 31, 1905, Englishmen in a land where reported witchcraft is of common occurrence were startled. This tabooed subject had been brought up in Parliament. A member of the House of Commons had told of a case of witchcraft, and had asked for an investigation. See back to Mysterious Thefts. Accept data and implications of almost any of the succeeding groups of stories, and cat burglars, and other larcenous practitioners, become thinkable as adepts in skills that are not describable as physical. Dean Forest Mercury, May 26, 1905. That £50 had been stolen from a drawer in the home of John Markey near Blakeney, Dean Forest. The disappearance of this money was considered unaccountable. Just why, I could not find out, because the influence of taboo smothered much, in this case. The members of this household could not explain how this money could have vanished, and brooding over the mystery made them superstitious. They asked a woman, who, according to her reputation, had much knowledge of witchcraft, to investigate. Then came occurrences that made them extremely, hysterically, insanely superstitious. It was as if an invisible resented the interference. Soon after the arrival of this woman Ellen Haywood, something went through this house, smashing windows, crockery, and other breakables. That is about all that I can pick up from the local newspaper, and from other newspapers published in the neighborhood. Markey's daughter broke down, with terror. There is only this record, no particulars of her experiences. Without detail, or comment, it is told that Markey's granddaughter became insane. Both women were removed, one to a hospital, and the other to an asylum. Markey's wife ran screaming from the house, and hid in the forest. A police inspector came from Gloucester, and organized a search for her, but she was not found. For 3 days, without food or shelter, she hid. Then she returned, telling that she had seen the searchers, but had been in such a state of terror by whatever was censored out of the records that she had been afraid to come out of hiding. Markey's son became violently insane, smashing furniture, and seriously injuring himself, crying out that the whole family was bewitched. He, too, was taken to an asylum. There was a demand for an inquiry into this case, and it was voiced in the House of Commons. It was voiced against taboo. There is no more to tell. I have notes upon another case that looks like resentment against an intrusion if a woman died, but not in an epileptic fit, as alleged. There were accounts in the London newspapers, but I take from a local newspaper, the Wisbech Advertiser, February 27, 1923, home of Mr. Scrimshaw, at Gore Field, near Wisbech. Other members of Scrimshaw's household were his mother, aged 82, and his daughter, Olive, aged 16. The phenomena were in the presence of this girl. First, Mrs. Scrimshaw's lace cap rose from her head. Then a washstand crashed to the floor. Objects, such as books, dishes, a water filter, fell to the floor. There was much smashing of furniture and crockery. Names of neighbors, who witnessed these unconventionalities, are John Fenlow, T. Merrick, W. Maxey, and G. T. Ward. A piano that weighed 400 pounds moved from place to place. Police Constable Hudson was a witness of some of the phenomena. As to a suggestion that, for any reason of notoriety, or hoaxing, Scrimshaw could be implicated, it was noted that the damage to furniture amounted to about £140.